You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
So a very huge welcome to all of you to the No Fly Zone. And it is a privilege and a delight to introduce your host and compere for this next session, who is the author of the blog Small Flowers Break Concrete, and also one of the beating hearts of the campaign and advocacy team at Christian Aid. It's Bella Cross.
Thank you. Thanks for that very kind introduction, Callum. Welcome. So glad that you could make it, especially given the rain, but we'll move on. I'd like to offer an even warmer welcome to our panellists for joining us today. They'll be coming up on the screen one by one, so don't panic. You can just see one at the moment. As per the blurb, there is a growing global debt crisis that is trapping low-income countries in poverty, and private companies are lining their pockets in the process. We have the privilege of a fantastic panel of young activists here to talk about what they see as the root causes of debt, the multifaceted impacts they're seeing in their communities, and what alternative systems they're working to build. So we'll start with a series of questions to the panelists, and then hopefully we'll have some time for Q&A from all of you. For the panelists, I'm not sure if you can see, but we've got a good crowd going here today. So without further ado, let me introduce our panel. Jarvan, do you just want to say hello and then you'll come up on the screen?
Yeah, thank you very much. Can you hear and see me?
We can. So Jarvan Ofula is a Kenyan human rights advocate, coalition builder, creative artist working at the intersection of justice, governance, and the arts. He is a leader in grassroots organizing, youth mobilization, and a convener of diverse groups to advance accountability and democratic participation. Anne Gashui, could you just say hello?
Hello, everyone. Happy to be here.
Thank you. Gashui Agnes Kariuki is a Kenyan lawyer, governance expert, member of the Jubilee Party, and a human rights defender dedicated to building a resilient, inclusive democracy. Driven to empower disenfranchised groups, particularly women and youth, she actively combats political apathy and illiteracy. Agnes is the founder of, I should have asked you how to say this before, Utsawiki.
Utsawiki.
Thank you. A youth-led accountability think tank enhancing civic duty, preparing young candidates for the next general election and researching political extremism. And last but certainly not least, Precious, do you want to say hello?
Hello, everyone. Nice to be here.
Thanks. Precious Kalumbwana is a Zambian climate and social justice activist and community organizer working with Citizens Network for Community Development in Zambia. Her work focuses on climate justice, debt justice, women and youth empowerment, and supporting vulnerable communities affected by drought and economic inequality. She advocates for fair global systems that prioritize people, communities, and environmental sustainability. Who am I? Well, yeah, I'm Bella. I'm currently a campaigns officer at Christian Aid, and my job is to support people like you to feel confident, to use your power to support debt and climate justice. So let's give our panelists a very warm welcome. Amazing. So before we start, some of you, hands up, who remembers the Jubilee debt campaign? Okay, that's a good number of hands. Who was involved? Amazing, great, okay. So you'll remember that this was a huge win for people power. People across the world, churches in the UK really came together to demand debt justice. And that resulted in $130 billion worth of debt cancelled for low-income countries, which is incredible, a real testament to what we can do together. But when this debt was cancelled, it was the public lenders that paid for it, not the private lenders. So what has happened is that private lenders like banks and asset managers have started offering more and more loans to countries with extremely high interest rates. The average is 6.2%, which is huge. And there are basically no rules to rein them in and keep them in check. Recurring shocks like COVID, various oil crisis, food crisis, mean that countries are having to borrow more and more. Except because of the high interest rates, the debt keeps growing and they borrow more than from the same lenders who keep making a profit from it. The result is that there are 34 African countries that are now spending more on debt than their healthcare systems and or their education systems, which should be absolutely shocking for all of us. Just some numbers for you. The total amount of money that all the African countries owed in debt in 2023 was 85 billion. And I don't know about you, but when I hear numbers like that, it's beyond me, you know? But what the UK sends in aid, for context, is 1.5 billion. So that's 50 times more is coming back out of Africa, all of that money back into banks, asset managers, profits that are located in the global north. And that is reproducing or upholding colonial dynamics where these resources continue to flow from the global south to the global north. And that number continues to rise. In 2024, it's 104 billion. Hopefully that's a quick whistle-stop tour of the current global debt crisis. And we're having this conversation based in the UK. There's a really important link to be made here. Our panelists are joining from Zambia and Kenya, two countries that liberated themselves from former British colonial rule. But colonialism didn't disappear in 1964 and 1963. It is very much still here today, and that's what we're here to talk about. So this is a question for all of our panelists. Precious, as you're first on the screen, would you like to go first? How do you see colonialism impacting your country today, or colonial dynamics still at play?
Thank you so much, Bella. I think I'll start with when you talk about independence, you talk, you think of you are fully independent as a country. But for us as Zambia, as a country, we got independence in 1964, but we are not fully independent as a country. Somehow we are still depending on some colonial rule from 1964 from the Northern Rhodesia. For me, colonization did not simply disappear when Zambia became independent in 1964. The political flag changed, but many of the economic structures remained as we are suffering. We are heavily indebted as a country. Zambia was stopped along the extraction of natural resources, particularly copper, for the benefit of the external economies. Today, our economy is still heavily dependent on extraction and export of mineral resources. So for myself, I ask myself, who owns the resources, who benefits from them, and who carries the environmental and social costs? We can also talk about how our countries are benefiting and who is owing who and who is benefiting. After colonization, a lot of things happen. We are still colonizing in our country. I see a similar dynamic that debt system we towards the development means borrowing money, extracting more resources from our country. Our country is still colonized, but Similarly, we are also done that. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Precious. And yeah, you've raised a really important point about the resource extraction continuing, not just through the debt, but literally the physical resources, which left Zambia entering the global economy at a deeply unequal position. And then these systems and structures in the global financial system have been set up to keep it that way. Thank you. Gashiri, would you like to come in on that?
Yes, Bella, thank you for the opportunity again. In my opinion, how does colonialism still impact Kenya today? Of course, Kenya was a former British colony, and we got our independence in 1963 and became officially a republic in 1964. There was a constitution that was drafted around that time. We call it the Lancaster House Constitution. And in a lot of ways, that constitution was meant to still protect certain colonial interests. And that has had ripple effects to this very day. But allow me to just mention the fact that systemic global structures where, you know, private companies and international financial institutions from the global north tend to have structures that trap low-income countries, and especially former colonies that already started their journeys as republics or as independent nations from a disenfranchised point. So they find themselves in this particular rat race, economic rat race, where they constantly are in debt, constantly have to find ways of rationalizing bad economic policies within their countries. And effectively, that in turn is expressed or finds itself being expressed in terms of civilian strife, because more often than not, bad economic policies will always translate to bad public service. It will always translate to repression of democracy and human rights. And that, again, now has the impact of response from civilians. That's one way to look at it. Another example I would give for us, particularly in Kenya, is our relationship with the British Army and what we have in Kenya, known as a training zone north of Mount Kenya in an area called Laikipia. The Batuk, or the British unit that trains in Kenya, has had for a couple of years an arrangement with the Kenyan government that is very lopsided in terms of power dynamics, which gives military, members of the British military who happen to train and live in that area, some level of diplomatic immunity. So when there are instances of clash or running with the laws, more often than not, they are not faced with the consequences. There have been so many instances of femicide specifically within that particular region. And Bella, just to emphasize, Kenya had a very protracted struggle with the Mau Mau between 1952 and 1963, who were fighting for freedom from the British colonial government. And a lot of these people find themselves in that region. A lot of the disenfranchisement and occupation of settlers is still well within living memory. So every time there are instances where you have British Army officers running the laws and then, you know, they're protected, they're hidden, it evokes a lot of emotions and a lot of wounds. And in my, you know, in my view, that is in a lot of ways how colonialism still plays out in Kenya today. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Yeah, and such a powerful point to raise about the trauma that is raised through the presence of the British Army there and the continued real lack of accountability and proper reparations for the atrocities that the British committed in Kenya. Thank you. Jarvan, over to you.
Hello, can you hear me?
We can.
Good. Thank you very much for that question. And also thank you to Precious and Agnes Gashui for giving their submissions. Of course, from where I sit is that most of the structuring of how things are being run in Kenya is that we mostly still depend on the colonial systems of running. And this goes further even to how the policing of the country is done. And this we've seen with the most recent protests, where there's a lot of excessive use of force. This is not necessarily how we would love to be.
Well, I think we've lost it, but Abella, may I just chime in a little bit on his
please.
Point, although I didn't know his train of thought.
Yeah.
But the conversation around police brutality in Kenya does always draw its origins from how policing was done during colonial era. Remember, before colonization, we were different ethnic nations. We were not, you know, consolidated as this lump called Kenya, Republic of Kenya, or just Kenya. So for us to be able to be put within those boundaries and run as a country or as a territory, they had to come with a uniform policing system. And that particular policing system has remained unchanged for the most part to this day, even with the dispensation of a new constitution. When is this? On Thursday, we were celebrating 16 years of our new constitution that began its dispensation in 2013. So that's roughly around 13 years ago. And within that particular constitution, we talked about police reforms, moving it from a force to a service, so that it has a more humane, you know, appeal to it and a front facing towards the public. But still, we struggle so much with the concept of colonial structures in terms of policing and security in this country. I didn't know what Javan's train of thought was, but I thought I should probably just add that to what he was saying.
Thank you. And we're gonna come back to that and dig in a bit more, because you've mentioned the protests and the violence that was inflicted on the protesters. But for now, Precious, let's go to you. Could you maybe tell us a bit more about what the impacts of the debt crisis are in Zambia? How has it impacted you, your family, your community? What would you like to share?
Thank you so much, Bella. Thank you so much, Agnes, for that contribution. For me, debt has brought more harm in my country. Right now, debt in Zambia, 30% of our annual budget, we repay loans. And when I talk about how debt has impacted our country, it is something that I have experienced as a mother, as a woman. Debt has brought more harm than good to our country. When I talk about...
Oh, we can't hear you anymore, Precious. You're on mute.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, you're back.
Oh, thank you so much. Debt has impacted our communities, especially where I come from. As a young girl in a community, knowing that this is climate change, we didn't know that climate and debt, they are interlinked, they work together. But this time around, when you think of going to the hospital, when you see families that they don't have food on their table because of debt, because our country is heavily indebted. Just last year, when my father's house was swept away by the floods, it was so devastating. It was very traumatizing when my cousin called me that, Precious, your father's home was swept away by the floods. I was very terrified. I was so scared because I thought of what now has happened to my father's house. When I went there, my father said, Precious, I don't have a home right now. Precious, I'm going to another land. I'm moving away because of climate change. And I'm moving away to the land, from the land that I buried my wife. I'm moving away from the land, from my ancestral land, and it was very traumatizing to me. And to see families in my community, they don't have access to clean water, they don't have access to good quality education, they don't have access to good sanitation. And this is what is happening in our country. These are real stories that are happening in our communities because we are heavily indebted. And when we think of the things that are happening in our communities, it's like something that you can try to target to say, demanding this, but the government right now can't fight poverty. The government right now can't fight climate change because it's heavily indebted. Just recently, we had droughts. People can't afford buying solar so that they can lighten their houses because we depend on hydro power. Most of the people died in the hospitals because they were not connected to solar panels. And this has brought more harm in our communities. More families in my community don't eat maybe 3 times a day because it's highly economic. Everyone is suffering because of debt. Thank you so much, Bella.
Thank you so much for sharing that, Precious, and for highlighting how interconnected these crises are. The more that countries are spending on debt, paying banks and asset managers, the less that they are able to invest in climate resilience to support the people of their country with very basic services to power the generators in hospitals. And that is an injustice that should enrage us all. Okay, Gashui, we're coming to you next. Over the past few years, there's been a series of youth protests in Kenya to reject a finance bill. And it goes deeper than that, but could you spell it out for us? Why have so many young Kenyans been rising up to fight this?
I think I should start from perhaps just before the lockdown to give a proper history of what has been happening. We had a really bad tiff in terms of post-election disagreements in 2017 between the then president and the opposition leader. There was a level of, stalemate in how governance is done in this country. And then afterwards, for some reason, the government decided to have a handshake. We have a culture of handshake, which means reconciliation between the echelon of political class in this country after a disputed election. And from that particular arrangement, they decided to clamp down on how financial systems, government financial systems and public services are done in this country to make sure that money is channeled right back to the national government from the grassroots and what we call devolved governments, which are probably what would be called county council governments in Britain. I don't know. Because of that particular arrangement, there was less money in circulation. Devolution really suffered. Devolution is what we call decentralized government here in Kenya, and it was one of those realizations of political self-determination in Kenya that had to be done with the new constitution after what we went through in 2007, where we had a very bloody post-election dispute that almost got this country to the brink of a civil war. So come 2020, we go straight into the lockdown. That in part affects greatly small-scale traders in this country, some of whom have never recovered to this day. And then you have, of course, the Russian conflict in Ukraine, Russia's unjust aggression against Ukraine, which significantly also impacted how things are done in this country and how we went about solving debts. It doesn't help that the legislature then and now were very apathetic to public outcry regarding public finance management and raising the ceiling on solvent debt in Kenya. So increasingly, less money in the system, less money in the pockets of youths in this country. And, that just continued getting worse, even now the new administration that came in 2022. We had the first dispute regarding the finance bill in 2023 that sought to increase taxations, levies, and economic punitive measures in this country to ensure that we are able to pay debts to international financial institutions. And a lot of Kenyans tried to express this through the opposition league at the time, or the opposition team, And it was very bloody. More than 200 young people were killed. And then now that was used or weaponized by the opposition leaders at the time to have another reconciliation arrangement, I'm putting that in quotes, reconciliation arrangements with the executive. So the executive thought, oh, we have the opposition in our pocket. We can be able to do whatever we want. This in turn, of course, means less money in the public healthcare system, less money in public education. And as it is, we have a new curriculum that we do not understand very well. So we and it's quite demanding in terms of how much is spent on each particular learner, each particular child as a learner. That already means there's so many children who are disenfranchised. We now have very high dropout rates and truancy rates amongst children. And young people who want to join university, we colloquially call it campus here, young people who want to join university are unable to do that and are extremely disenfranchised because they're not able to pay. And the new university model that again falls under the public education system is extremely punitive and is, it seems, seeks to have less learners joining university in Kenya. That in itself is a very dangerous and radicalizing fate for young people in this country. So the government was under the view, was of the view that now we have the position, we can do whatever it is we want. Come 2024, and I think it's important for me to mention that we had had a series or a history, a very bad history of gender-based violence in Kenya, a lot of femicide in the country, the climax was, of which was January 2024. Young women decided enough is enough. Young women mobilized across the country and young women shut this country down. As always, I say I'm very proud to have been part of that. We did a total shutdown to get the government's attention to deal with gender-based violence issues against women, children, and also issues of femicide. Now, that particular expression, political expression of discontent was how we were able to map out again and have another conversation around public finance management and the finance bill of 2024 in 2024. So, of course, the Exchequer would give suggestions in February and March of what it is they want. And the first draft of the finance bill was submitted to Parliament in March of 2024. Of course, young people were able to have a look at that document. And women again, young women again, began the conversation on social media because it significantly affected reproductive health and especially when it comes to issues, access to menstrual health products. There were so many punitive measures on pads and other menstrual health products. They were trying as much as possible to discourage the buying of products that are imported, to also encourage the production here locally, which is not a bad thing, but more often than not, because I am in that space of, you know, gender welfare and whatnot, are substandard. So, and you know, menstruation is a biological function. It's not something that women can decide whether they want to menstruate or not. It's a function, it happens. So why not ensure that they have the most humane and dignified ways of having their function proceed? So young women were very irritated by that. And of course, some of our female parliamentarians were very insensitive in how they responded to these queries. And then, of course, there was a lot, we could see that there was a lot of interference by certain diplomatic representatives in the country who would even make a point of being in Parliament's gallery while this particular finance bill is being, well, the motion is on the floor. So in April and May, young people continued to express this particular grievance and even went as far as speaking to their parliamentarians, parliamentary representatives. This is the first time we see this in Kenya. We had never seen a situation where Kenyans overwhelmingly speak to their parliamentarians, telling them, do not vote for this particular bill. But they were very clear, do not vote for the finance bill, reject the finance bill. In fact, that's the hashtag to this day, reject the finance bill. Again, the response was very bad from the state. The response was very bad from a lot of the legislators. They called young people terrorists. They called young people treasonous, which, you know, when you have a hardlining government, the response from the people will equally be very, very hardlining. And that is what started the protests in late of May 2024, where young people decided, if you people will not listen to us, we are going to come to Parliament, we are going to submit our petition, and we are going to ask the speakers to ensure that this thing does not see the light of day. The pushback was very violent, and we saw what happened on 25th June 2024, which now sits in the very darkest days of Kenya's history. A lot of young people were murdered across the country, but especially in Parliament. But that particular conversation then
forced us to have another conversation around economics, unjust economic practices, unjust economic interferences from the global north and international financial systems. Even on that particular day when young people decided to go to march to parliament and walk into parliament, whether by force or diplomatically, there were representatives from diplomatic communities and international financial institutions who were there to supervise, let me put that in quote again, to supervise that finance bill that was very punitive, that sought to only pay debts, more to debt and less to public service in this country, sail through so that it would then go to the next chamber, which is Senate.
Thank you. That was really comprehensive. And we can see the knock-on effects that when countries are forced to pay more and more on debt, austerity is imposed, people's living conditions go down. I think when we spoke before, you've mentioned period products here, but also things on tax on bread, everyday staple products that people need, hikes on it, all to line the pockets of these bankers. And that undermines democracy and accountability.
That is true, yeah.
Jarvin, I think you're back now. That's great. You're an artist and a community organizer, and you've been really involved in that building power within communities that are rising up to push for your rights and for your voice to be heard. Can you tell us more about how communities are responding to these challenges? And what are the lessons that we can learn from this?
Thank you very much. And also thank you, Tuga Shui, for stepping in when my internet had a bit of a jumble. I want to, again, just put it out there that Kenya's median age is 19 years old, meaning that the bigger population is young people whose future is on the line every day. With a failing health system, educational system, and all that, then young people and communities have to stand up. I have been part of many organizing, and not that I take a leading role, but only playing a catalytic role of, you know, bringing communities together. People now are very, very involved and very in legislative spaces, because Kenya's democracy from our constitution 2010 now gives the parliament a lot of power to decide what is done, when, and how. And we've seen that the young people's future is the one that is on the line. So then they have to come out, they have to push back, they have to communicate, they have also to participate. It's not only going to the streets, but also having a lot of public participation, as one that Agnes alluded to, where people asked the members of parliament not to vote for the punitive finance bill that seeked to put up a lot of taxes. And all this is done because, as you say again, most of our budget, with our most recent budget having more than 50% set aside only to pay debts, not to make, you know, our country better, not to make our education system or health system better, or even our farming. And with devolution, whereas now there's a bit of devolution of resources and functionalities to county levels, then there should be more funds that are channeled downwards to help communities elevate themselves. Now, the one big lesson that power is the ultimate power. What the people want is what should take lead. What the people tell their leaders to do, again, because they are just our representatives. But we've seen that lately the legislature and the judiciary has been captured. Thus then, most of Kenyan young people resort to protest as the last way of, you know, speaking up to what we need. And as an artist, using poetry and rap music, but also organizing on different levels, this is the one thing that still gives us hope that we can push back and most probably have, you know, a future that puts our needs, you know, as a priority. Thank you.
Thank you. Now, we've heard about the violence that has been enacted on protesters, but here in the UK, successive governments have been taking a more repressive approach to protest, to dissent, particularly around Palestine, around climate justice as well. And in general, there is just a concerning backslide on democracy globally. So I'd love to come to you first, Precious, to hear about how this is playing out in your context. If you're happy to share your story, if you're not, don't worry. And again, how is this connected to the issues we've been talking about, to debt, to colonialism?
I don't know where to start, because when we started the meeting, I was very nervous. I'm always nervous when I'm speaking to people and knowing that they are listening. So I was like, where am I going to start? And when I talk about activism, I'll start when I started my activism. It was when I was doing my secondary school back in my village, when we started experiencing climate change, where we can see where I saw that we started experiencing how climate change is affecting us, and how I started my activism at secondary school. I asked my teacher that, why are we experiencing droughts? What's the reason? Why are we facing these issues? It's when my geography teacher told me that, Precious, this is climate change. How can we combat climate change? And my teacher advised me to say, Precious, let's start planting trees. It's how I started planting trees in my community. After secondary, I had to move to Lusaka, a bigger city, for green pastures, for me to start looking for something for myself. And I realized that moving from my village to a bigger city in Lusaka, I started experiencing different climate situation. From my village, it was droughts. And here in Lusaka, I started experiencing floods, a lot of diseases like cholera. Decently, people were sick. I started researching again to say, what's happening? Why is this happening? And it came to a point that this is climate change. It's when I sat with my friends and we formed a Citizens Network for Community Development in Zambia. We started advocating for better livelihood and sustainable in our community. It's how we started pushing for climate talks, and also targeting the government to say we need funding for this. And we realized that we are not getting the funding that we need for us to implement projects in our communities. And to our surprise, we had to again to think, why is the government not helping in this such in these programs in implementing these projects that are affecting the communities? We started again questioning the government. It's when we find out that our country is heavily indebted. The government can't fight poverty. Our governments can't fight climate change, because 30% of our annual budget, we repay loans. And as a young lady, we had to see, how are we going to target? Who is responsible for this debt crisis? And our target was IMF, World Bank. We organized ourselves as youths in the community. We came up with a demand letter to deliver to World Bank. We marched that day in 2024. We organized ourselves and came up with a demand letter where we're going to deliver that letter to the World Bank. With our fellow youths, we marched to the World Bank, and at that moment, when we reached at the World Bank offices, we handled the letter, and they accepted the letter inside the secretariat. Just getting out of the office at the World Bank, four of us who went inside the office of the World Bank, we got arrested. We just saw a Land Cruiser full of men inside. And three of us, we were women, and one of them was man. And it was very traumatizing when we saw a Land Cruiser full of policemen said, "You disgruntled youths, you're the one who is disturbing these promises. Get inside." And from that day, when I was arrested, I was like, what's happening? Who's going to take care of my children? What are they going to arrest me and my fellow friends? It was very traumatizing. They had to take our phones and everything, but they had to ask again the police officer, "What are you doing there? Precious, we know you from planting trees. We have seen you going around planting trees. Why are you targeting this big institution?" I had to tell them, the police officer, for us, we enable a just transition. For us to have medicine in hospital, we need this date to be cancelled. This is our demand letter. The police officer had to lead through the demand letter, say, "Oh, this is quite good, but you shouldn't target these big institutions. You continue planting trees, Precious." I was it was very traumatizing to my side to see that people want us to plant more trees, not targeting these big institutions. That makes us not to have all the things that we need as a country. From that moment, when I got arrested, I couldn't sleep. I was thinking they would come again to my house. They had to detain us for 5 hours for interrogations. Until then, the following morning, I said to myself, "Oh, hell no, I'm stopping activism. I'm no longer doing this again. I don't want to endanger the future of my children." Until 3-4 days, the storm came and killed one of my neighbor's child. He died. And that woman came to me, "Precious, you have been advocating for climate change. These are the things that are happening. I've heard that you were arrested and you are planning to stop activism." And that moment is when I said to myself, "I'm not going back. I'm not resisting until my voice is heard." It's how I got the motivation of being an activist again, to say, people are dying. Let me not stop. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Yeah. What an incredible story. I mean, to go through something so traumatic, but for you, that is, you're living with, in your community, you're living with the reality of these crises every day. And you have, yeah, just carried on. It's incredible, and full solidarity to you, Precious. I think we are coming towards the end, so I'm going to actually move us on, if that's okay. Before the Q&A, keep thinking about the questions you'd like to ask, but a small request from me. There are not enough spaces where we can listen to amazing people like Precious, when we can listen and learn from activists from the Global South. So it is such a privilege to share this space together. If you're a bit of a policy nerd like me, you might have some quite technical, some niche questions. Our panelists are experts in their fields, in their context, but we can get answers to technical questions in reports. For me, the real value in this is the sharing the stories, it's the building the solidarity through that. So if you've got a specific question about a particular debt arrangement or anything like that, I'm hanging around, I'll be out and about. Please come speak to me afterwards. I'll try and answer your questions or find someone who can. So this will be our final question. And if we could try and keep it a little bit shorter, and then we will take questions from the audience. It's a big one, but what does an end to colonialism look like? Who'd like to go first?
I am ready, can I?
Great, thank you.
Yeah, thank you for this opportunity again, and of course also to the participants who are listening in. A true end to colonialism would be a space where we are able to determine our futures in our own terms, long-term future, because again, as I shared, even the debt and, you know, debt repayment systems and the banking systems and the financial, like the finance bill, policies are majorly driven and pushed by external, you know, entities and big banks that are not locally, you know, established. What this then means is that most of the way things are done are not factoring our real realities on ground, our real realities in Kenya and, you know, most of the countries that we are borders and neighbors with. So to me, a true end to colonialism is where we are able to determine our future as a people. Of course, we will always remain as brothers and sisters across borders and share knowledge and good practices, but that is the actual meaning of end to colonialism to me. Thank you.
Thank you.
I think I can chime in.
Yes, please.
Of course, just to add to what Javana said, interference to self-determination is one of those things that would definitely need to end for us to say, you know, we can see an end to imperialism, to colonialism. But I would also add that, you know, there is a sense of brotherhood, even as we, you know, talk about colonialism and all these things. We've ended up having a way of creating brotherhood over the years and have common values, common goals, and especially when it comes to democracy, human rights, and freedom. So I think the other way we could say, you know, we are seeing an end to all this is, you know, a lot of support for democracy across the board, because this is a fundamental value of political determination and political expression, be it there in Britain or in the West generally, and a lot of the global South countries that were former British colonies. Democracy is fundamental to how human progress translates in every civilization, in every society. So I would add that maybe promotion of the same, be it at a private level, be it as a community with what we're seeing right now with the no-fly zone engagement, and also in speaking to our representatives on your side, on our side, and telling them, you know, we can see a situation where in a particular country there is a shrinking of democratic values. Let me give a good example. So Kenya is part of the East African community. The other countries are Tanzania, you have Uganda, you have Rwanda, and you have Burundi. But our immediate neighbors are Uganda and Tanzania. But because of the shrinking democratic space we have seen in the past 12 months or so, Kenyans are in a position where we are expressing concern for what is happening in those countries. It's not a good look for us, obviously, with the governments from those countries. And there is a time we were even being told, don't travel to a particular country. The situation there is very bad. They would not perceive you very well. But Kenyans have been the voice for the voiceless in Tanzania, have been the voice for the voiceless in Uganda, and increasingly applying pressure to our government to either speak the same language through foreign policy in these particular countries, or find a way of, you know, addressing it as part of the East African community. So that's the other way I would say that we look at an end to colonialism, brotherhood in terms of values or common values, and of course promote just global economic structures and just global economic systems, because the lopsided nature of power dynamics between the global north and the global south happens to be the way it is because of imperialism and colonialism. And the only way we can have a fair world is by ensuring that global economic systems are fair to everyone.
Thank you. You have a really important point raised there about the power of solidarity and what acknowledging what power we have and using that to be in solidarity with people across struggles, across borders. Precious, is there anything you'd like to add to this question What does an end to colonialism look like?
For me, ending colonialism means moving from extraction to liberation. Mm-hmm. And it means that my country having the power to decide what development looks like and their own power. It also means our natural resources being used first to improve the lives of the communities where those resources come from. And it also means we cannot be talking about the ending of colonialism while countries like mine are still spending enormous amounts of money saving debt. Mm-hmm. And for me, decolonization means who has the power most, who decides, and who owns the wealthy, whose knowledge counts, and whose lives are considered valuable. Thank you so much.
Thank you. What an important line to end on there. Whose lives matter and whose count? We think we've got time for one or two questions.
Thanks so much for sharing your stories. If the debt was cleared, what's sort of the next step to avoid it happening again?
Does anyone want to answer that?
Can I go?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think again, it would be really great for all the debts to be cleared. That will be a true, you know, progressive experience. The next best step would be, you know, having the government manage its local resources to an extent that it serves its people without having priorities that, and this is what Precious talked to, extraction, because most of the development agendas that are set sometimes are not to serve the local needs. So first would be to have agendas and you know, plans that serve the local needs with a budget or approximation that can be served with our local resources over time, so that then when that can be attained, we are sure to, you know, be able to run has been proven to be available, because also most of our resources are being extracted and not used locally, or even the deals that are done with external corporations are very unfair. So it will be to clear the debts, then have very fair relationships in terms of any resources that are either, you know, taken to be used for local purposes or external purposes. Thank you.
Thank you. And so you were asking more about that point, about how do we stop this cycle from happening again. Yeah, there's a piece of legislation that will be re-entering Parliament this year. About 90% of these private lenders from these loans are governed by English law. So the UK government actually has a really oversized role in this situation. And this piece of legislation is working to stop private lenders being able to use English courts to sue countries for more money than their repayments, which is happening. And we're also pushing to kind of set up, there's really no regulation of this globally. There's no rules. So that's one thing, but should we move on to the next question?
Thanks for sharing this morning. It was really good to hear from all of you. I was wondering, as activists, are you receiving any kind of support, or what kind of support have you received from institutional churches like Anglican Church, Methodist Church, for the work that you're doing and in the struggles that you're having?
Can I go next?
Yes, please.
In running my organization, Ustawi KE, I have worked closely with the Catholic Justice and Peace Department that does a phenomenal job here in Kenya in terms of you know, creating sensitization and awareness on matters governance, good governance. Remember, good governance is a fundamental part of the conversation around social justice and Christianity, and especially for the more conservative denominations of Christianity. Anyway, for me, I have done a good raft of work with the Catholic Justice and Peace Department in terms of creating sensitizations, in terms of having conversations around radicalization and extremism, and also in, you know, a series of trainings on public finance management for young people since the 2024 finance bill fiasco. As far as other organizations are concerned, in Kenya specifically, I think the Catholic Church is the only one I have seen work with private organizations or public-facing NGOs to address issues of governance, good governance, and public finance management. I could be wrong.
Thank you. I would have loved to get into your story about how young people were using the church as a space to speak up and speak truth to power. Yeah. But near the end, anyone else want to come in on that? Were you referring more to like the UK church, or you talk church locally
in those places,
in their context? Okay.
Sorry, Bella, come again.
I was just checking if the others wanted to add anything or not. If not, should we? Oh yeah, go on.
Perhaps. Yeah, maybe as they prepare to come on again. It is important for me to mention, now that you've pointed it out, that in 2024, the church was very critical in the conversation around public finance management and promotion of public participation as a fundamental of democratic expression in Kenya. I saw my church, specifically the Catholic Church, give young people a platform to express themselves in church. I don't know if you've seen that video, I could share it after this, of how young people were given a chance to speak in church about the public finance management in the country, the finance bill, and encourage congregants to speak to their legislators to ensure that they did not vote for that punitive finance bill. So beyond that, the church has also been a very instrumental referee when this headlining climate came into the country. But it's also important for me to mention something else. Remember, I'm also a researcher in the area of extremism in Kenya, cultural extremism and political extremism. As we speak right now, Kenya's number one existential threat is political goonism. And the church has not been spared by politicians in this country, and especially the Anglican church. We have seen at least three instances, Jevon can correct me if I'm wrong, three instances where the Anglican church has had engagements for its congregants or parishioners to deliberate on civic education, as we have a general election next year. So the church, of course, is trying to have conversations with their congregants, preparing them for the next election and preparing for a peaceful election. But politicians don't want to hear that. So in Nairobi and in Kisumu, a lakeside city, I think there have been three instances where goons have been called upon congregants within church premises to terrorize them, to stop meetings, to intimidate clerics, to ensure that the church does not have a say in political conversations in this country.
Wow. We have seen a similar thing here with church spaces being used to arrest people involved in organizing. I think we're at the end of time. I'm really, really sorry to the both of you that you can't come in on that. I usually like to end these conversations with a question around hopes, but all of our participants have joined in with the Hotline of Hope audio exhibition. There's a box over there, but just find anyone in a red t-shirt and you'll be able to find it. They've recorded messages reflecting on where they see hope in action and what hope means to them. They're really, really powerful, really beautiful. I totally recommend just taking a moment to listen to those today. I want to thank you again for coming. Thanks for sitting through. I'm getting cold up here, so I'm sure all of you are feeling chilly as well. But most importantly, I hope you're feeling fired up about this. Yeah, it really enrages me. You can follow all of our panelists' work via their Instagrams. Maybe the easiest way is by finding the pinned post on @theCAcollective. That's @theCAcollective on Instagram. Find them through there. Again, go and listen to the Hotline of Hope, alongside many other activists who are also great. And if you're a super fan of me, because I know that's all why you're here, some of the activists who spoke last year have also contributed. So that's brilliant. There's also a game with a prize. Can I get a woo? Thank you. See how much hope you can catch, / foam balls. It's not about the competition, but it also is. I think it's a £50 Lush voucher today, so go and see if you can win. Amazing. You may have seen, I haven't seen it, but there's a film playing that we filmed with Precious, an incredible interview with Precious when she came to the UK. That's available to watch with an accompanying reflective resource that you can take back to your churches, to your community, to get into these topics, to reflect on debt, on colonialism, on our role as the church and as Christians in speaking up, being in solidarity with people at the forefront of these struggles. The best way to get your hands on that is to sign up to receive your own Greenbelt digital goodie bag. Can I get another? Ooh. Yeah, very exciting. Give us your email and we'll send you that. There's some other goodies in there, but I'll leave it to be a nice surprise. And always come and chat to me if you've got more questions, or the rest of our lovely volunteers in the red t-shirt. Get yourself a tattoo, why not? And I can point you towards some resources if you'd like further information. Have a wonderful rest of your festival. Let's give another huge round of applause to the panelists. Thank you so much, all of you. You're incredible.
Thank you so much, everyone here. Can we have one last big round of applause for everyone who's been part of this, for Bella and all of our speakers who have joined from around the world.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.